Bernie Wyatt, the naturalist. And you may have heard my first show that I did a few weeks ago. And we're going to continue the series now. And we had to take a short break because my terrific producer, Jack, had to go to Italy to meet, I hope, his future mother-in-law. And that's very nice. So he's back now, and we're back on the air. And today I have a special guest who is a colleague of mine from the Museum of Natural History. Her name is Carol Butler, Dr. Carol Butler. And I'm going to say hello to her now and find out something about her. And then we're going to talk today about mostly about butterflies. And we'll tell you why we picked that topic in a moment. So, Carol, would you like to say hello?
Hi, greetings. Thank you for inviting me to be on the show.
Okay. Carol, can you just tell me very briefly how you changed from a therapist for humans to a therapist for butterflies, Lepidopteras?
Well, okay, I would like to be a therapist for butterflies. I don't know that I can actually do that. It actually was coincidence. I was helping out on a beautiful Sunday morning in Central Park with a group called the Music and Dance.
Oh, traditional?
Traditional Music and Dance, yes. And somebody was there with a tent full of monarch butterflies that she raises. And I was standing outside the tent fascinated and listening to all the questions people were asking. And at a certain point, she needed to take a break. And I said, would you like me to go in the tent while you're gone? And she said, oh, that would be great. And I went in the tent, and I'm covered with monarch butterflies. And I was in complete heaven. That was it. And by that time, I knew the answers to a few of the questions that people were asking. And one of the women there said, oh, if you enjoy this so much, you should work at the Museum of Natural History in the Butterfly Conservatory. And I went home that night and put in my application and had an interview and started working there as soon as it opened.
Terrific. So that's actually how we met at the museum.
Yes.
And Carol got so interested in the butterflies that now she's on a new career of writing nature books. And she has a whole series of them. And Carol, you want to just tell us about your books, and then we'll get to the one on butterflies.
Okay. I had such a good time writing the butterfly book. I wrote it with Hazel Davis, who's the coordinator of the Butterfly Conservatory at the American Museum. And I said to my editor, I really enjoyed that. I had written a book 10 years ago on divorce mediation, and it was 10 years ago, there was quite a difference in the computer facilities and this sending attachments back and forth and just sending photographs over the internet. It was just wonderful. And I said, I'd love to do it again. And she said, how about doing two books a year? And I was delighted and said, okay. And so I did one on bats with Elizabeth Capaldi Evans, who is in the faculty of Bucknell University. I did one on hummingbirds with George West, who's a retired ornithologist from University of Alaska. And I did one on birds of prey with Peter Capagnolo from the museum, who's in the ornithology department. Am I leaving one out?
And you're working on one now, you told me also. Horses or no?
It's an idea that I have.
Okay,
I'd like to do one on horses.
It hasn't gotten out of the gate yet.
Right,
say,
exactly.
Exactly. So when we mention the museum on this program, we're talking about the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, and we'll talk about the museum on and off. But today's topic is going to be about the monarch butterfly. Two reasons. First of all, our butterfly conservatory just opened, and it will now be opened until May. And we'll tell you how you can go visit and all that. And this is the time of the year that the monarch butterflies are on their way to, believe it or not, to Mexico. So I'll turn it over to Carol, and she's going to tell us about the amazing migration of this little bit of protoplasm from New York City. It's about 2,000 miles to where they go.
Okay. I also wrote a book about bats. I forgot that
one. Oh, you mentioned
that. And that's important because we're going to talk about bats at another...
Bats will be another show.
Right. That I did with Barbara French.
Okay.
Where to start? There are about more or less 200,000 Lepidoptera, which are butterflies and moths. And there are about 20,000 butterflies, and the rest are moths. So just to fit monarchs in the population there.
Yeah, there are about, what, 500,000 moths or 250,000?
Yeah, at least 200,000 moths. And we know most of the butterflies because they're big and colorful and they've been studied a lot. But 90% of the moths have not been identified. And if you meet young Lepidoptera students, they're studying micromoths. They're all busy with these tiny little moths, identifying them left and right because there are so many of them. So that's really where the field is at the moment.
Okay, what does a Lepidoptera mean, Carol? So we'll fill the people in on that. You know, I learned that the word Lepidoptera means scale-winged.
Right.
So I think it comes from the Greek.
Right.
And the last part of it, lepra, means scaly skin or scale-like. And I think doptera is spelled P-E-T.
Right.
And it's like the flying dinosaur.
Right.
Has that same part to its name. So right. Go ahead, Carol. Thanks.
No, it's okay. So we know a lot about monarchs because they have been studied a great deal. And so, unlike micromoths, the first tagging project for monarchs was begun in the 30s by a fellow in Toronto named Urquhart. I'm not sure. U-R-Q-U-H-A-R-T, Fred. And he began tagging the monarchs and getting people to tag them because they knew they were going somewhere, but they didn't know where they were going. And then he would go with a group of people to Mexico every time he could manage and look around. And it wasn't until 1975 that they actually located the main areas where the monarchs migrate to.
Carol, how can you tag a butterfly? The butterfly weighs hardly anything.
Right.
So what are the tags like? They must be very tiny. And
right.
And
we have pictures of them in the butterfly book, actually. The tags are little tiny paper tags, and they put them on the wing of the butterfly. I was just at the Wetlands Institute in Stone Harbor, New Jersey, and now is the time the monarchs are migrating. And people down there who live in rural areas were talking very excitedly to me about tagging monarchs. They had gotten their tagging kits from Monarch Watch and from the other organizations that coordinate this, and they were busy tagging the monarchs that came into their yards.
And the purpose of the tagging?
Well, what they do is they collect the monarchs in Mexico and to see where they came from. And so they're tagged from all over the Northeast and Canada and the West Coast, and then they can tell where they migrate to. And what they found is that generations later, the next year, they go to the same place, which is incredible. How they know that, we have no idea. But that's how the tagging is, to figure out the flight path that they have, the destination.
The migration routes,
right. Yeah. So they go, now there are monarchs in other places. We're just talking about the ones in North America, but there are monarchs in Costa Rica, there are monarchs in other places, and they also migrate. But the big migration is here. And they go to a very small area in the fir forests in the highlands of central Mexico, Sierra Madre Mountains, which are 3,000 miles above sea level. And it's very damp and cold there, which is the first thing that's surprising, because they're migrating from the Northeast because it's getting cold and because the milkweed is drying up. That's their food. And so you would think they'd be going to a warm place where they'd have plenty of food, but that's not the case. The generation of monarchs that migrates is different from the other generations that emerge during the year. There are three or four other generations during the year. They live a few weeks. Within 4 or 5 days, they're ready to reproduce, and they go about their business, and they don't go anywhere. But the migratory generation is different because they're going to live for months, and they're not sexually mature. So they don't breed. They fly to Mexico. It takes them a couple of months. And then they go into diapause, which is a resting state in these cold, damp trees in Mexico until the spring, until the weather warms up. And then their sexual organs complete their development, and they mate. And then as the milkweed starts to grow, they start flying back north, laying eggs as they go. And the eggs develop, and those butterflies pupate and emerge and fly back, so that the parent can never say never, but not very many butterflies actually make the two-way trip. They travel down, they travel partway up, and then they die, and the offspring continue the trip.
Okay, so it's a long flight from, especially like New York would be 2,000 miles.
Right.
So at this point, we're going to just stop for a second. And this program is being brought to you by TechServe. And it's coming to you over the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting from Roberta's in beautiful downtown Bushwick. This is Bernie Wides. We're back on the air, and we were talking about the amazing migration of the monarch butterfly. It's one of the longest migrations of any critter, especially of any insect. Okay, some birds have very long migrations too, but think of this tiny, tiny little monarch butterfly and going all the way to Mexico.
The equivalent would be a butterfly, a monarch from Canada, let's say, from the northernmost part of the range, flying to the Oyamel fir forest in Mexico, would be the equivalent of a tall person going around the equator 11 times. That's the distance in terms of body length.
No, that lets me out. I'm not a tall person. It'll probably take me longer to do that. So have you ever seen the migration, Carol, or part of it?
I was at a butterfly event in Mission, Texas a few years ago, and it was sort of the tail end of the migration, and we saw clumps of monarchs resting in the trees, but what was incredible was I saw them riding on the thermals, and the turkey vultures were also migrating at that time. So you look up in the sky, and there's this cloud drifting of turkey vultures, and in among the turkey vultures were the monarchs. It was incredible.
Yeah, can you just tell our audience what a thermal is?
Air currents, they glide on the currents. They couldn't possibly flap their wings and power themselves all that way. It would use up much more energy. Mm-hmm. They're as high as, they were really very high, like 10,000 feet in the air. And they soar a lot of the distance. They just float on those thermals and just keep themselves pointed in the right direction.
Yeah, so they do the same thing that the raptors do, the birds.
Yeah, with the turkey
vultures and the hawks and those. And the thermals are those nice warm air currents that rise up. So when I learned about birds, birds go from one thermal to the next, to the next, to the next. And the butterflies have learned to do the same thing.
Right.
If you live in the New York area and you want to see the beginning of the migration from here, if at the beginning of October or middle of September, if you go out to Fire Island, which has a lot of evergreen trees on it, and you could see the butterflies all over the trees, and you could see them all flying west. And if the winds are right and it's a beautiful day, they'll be flying west along Long Island. They jump over the entrance to the Hudson, over New Jersey, and then they head southwest. How do they know where to go, Carol? What did you find out in your research?
Well, it's not my research, but there's a lot of research about this. They have an inborn compass, a time-compensated sun compass, so that the length of the day and the position of the sun are what they navigate by. We know that. There's new research that's very interesting that's not in the book. It just came out although Urquhart had observed this 50 years ago, they finally did research on it. No one had followed up. And they found that if they removed the antenna from the butterfly, they lost their way. Hmm. And then they painted the antenna black, and they also couldn't navigate. So clearly the antenna has some function that relates to navigation, and that's true. They've done research with other moths where they saw the antenna had a role in direction. But the piece of equipment that I just love is this flight simulator that got me very interested in this whole issue of navigation. If you imagine just a big translucent cylinder placed vertically, and it has a fan blowing air up from the bottom through a hole in the bottom, and one monarch at a time is tethered to a stalk made of tungsten wire, and they put beeswax on the back end of the butterfly's abdomen and attach it to the wire, and the wire is ultimately connected to a computer, of course. And a butterfly that's been in the laboratory under normal day-night conditions, hook them up in the flight simulator, and it'll fly southwest, which is the direction based on where they were collected. When they monkey around with the light-dark schedule in the laboratory and throw their time sense off, they fly differently. They compensate for the time change and fly in a different direction, which is observable. The other thing that's interesting, we know that butterflies are very sensitive to ultraviolet light. We know that, we talk about that in the conservatory. They can find the center of a flower because they see the ultraviolet light and the petals. They see it when they're looking for a mate. They can see the ultraviolet patterns on a butterfly of the opposite sex, right?
Yeah, right. We never see that, but they can see it.
Right.
And the flowers look different to them. Right. And I guess other butterflies look different too.
Right. We have photographs in the book of the flowers as they look through with ultraviolet light. It's very interesting because it's very different. But when they put them in the flight simulator and they put an ultraviolet filter over the top, they stop flying.
Mm.
So we also, obviously, the ultraviolet is from the sun, and that's the sun part of the compass. So it's the sun, the relationship of the ultraviolet rays from the sun and the time sense, the circadian rhythm that they have from the light-dark pattern.
Right. The circadian rhythm is this 24-hour clock that we have, too, some of it, I think.
Right.
Probably we don't use it as much as some of the animals, but I think most critters have it.
Oh, yeah. It's why you get jet lag
and why
people take melatonin to try to compensate.
Okay. So this circadian rhythm is You don't have to know how to dance to it. You don't have to have that kind of rhythm. It's a time rhythm, right? And so...
you were talking about the migration that you
had actually,
very interesting.
Okay. Carol said that she saw the migration on their way down in Texas, because most of these butterflies funnel through Texas. If they're flying east of the Rocky Mountains, anywhere in the country, they all funnel down through Texas. Big Bend is a great place to see them. I saw them once in Big Bend, and I was lucky enough to take a trip down to Michoacan in Mexico, which is a city, it's not too far from Mexico City, maybe it's 3 hours or 4 hours, and it's up in the mountains, and that's where these butterflies all congregate in the wintertime. And what they do is they huddle together on the trees. So if you looked at the tree and you saw a whole mass all clumped together, first you might think it's bees or a beehive, but there could be a million butterflies on this on the tree. And that's the way they keep warm, because, as Carol said, it's pretty chilly up there. So they huddle together for warmth, and they keep moving from the inside of this mass to the outside and flapping their wings to keep warm. And we didn't discuss this yet, but butterflies being insects, they can't produce their own heat except by friction, by flapping their wings.
They vibrate. Right?
They vibrate. They shiver.
They shiver
to do it, okay, because they're ectothermic,
right,
which means we are endothermic because we can produce heat in our body. Insects can't do that.
Right.
And I noticed when we saw them in Mexico, when the sun came out, they became active and they flew around. But when the sun wasn't shining, it was too cold.
Right.
If it's below 55, they can't really fly. So...
We see that in the conservatory.
Right.
In the book we wrote about, we listed about 200 butterfly conservatories all over the world, and I've been to several of them, and all of them are kept very warm for precisely this reason, so that the butterflies will be active. If it's too cold, they huddle up under the trees.
Mm. And Carol said they become active in the springtime in Mexico, which is probably... end of February, I would imagine. And they start flying north.
Right.
And
well, first they mate.
They mate. And then they fly north. And they're not going to live for 8 months, these returning butterflies. They'll live a couple of weeks.
Right.
So maybe at the first leg, they'll get to the Texas border.
Right.
And then they'll do the same thing. They'll mate. And then they'll die shortly after that. And then the next generation takes up the flight, flying north or northwest or northeast, and eventually it takes, depending how far, 4 or 5 generations to get back to where their great-great-great-grandparents came from. So think of that. They've never been up here, but they find their way back to where their ancestors were. And we'll continue this amazing story in a minute or two. I remind you that we're sponsored by TechServe. This is the Heritage Radio Network, and we'll talk to you. We'll be back in a minute. Hi, we're back. It's Carol Butler and Bernie Wides, the Naturalist program. And we're going to continue about the amazing migration of the monarch butterfly. And Carol, why is the milkweed so important and this life cycle of the butterfly. You said that they, in the springtime in Mexico, they follow as the milkweeds bloom, as the weather gets warmer and warmer, goes towards summer.
Right. No, I just think it's, I just love that image that the, where it's, of course, warmer in the south, the milkweed blooms first, and so they fly to that area, and as the warm weather moves north, the milkweed begins to flower, and as it flowers, the butterflies are moving north along with the milkweed. That's how a lot of migration happens, with not only with butterflies, with birds as well.
Okay, so the, is the milkweed important in the whole life cycle of the butterfly, or just for the adults?
No, the milkweed is, the adults drink the nectar from the milkweed, and then they lay the eggs on the milkweed leaves. And when the butterflies will only lay eggs on a plant that their caterpillar babies can eat. And so they lay the eggs on the leaf of the milkweed plant, and when the caterpillars come out, breakfast is ready.
Mm-hmm. How does the female know that it's a milkweed?
Good question.
Yeah.
They can tell. They can smell. Yeah, they scratch the surface of a plant and get a sense of the chemicals that are released. And they smell with their antenna. They taste with their feet. They have all kinds of sensory equipment that allows them to identify a host plant.
That's interesting that they can taste with their feet.
Yeah.
I don't think we can do that.
No.
I don't know if I can even how that works.
We're not that evolved.
No. So the milkweed is the important plant for the monarch butterfly.
Right.
I know that the monarch butterfly will nectar at many flowers, many different kinds, but for the female, it's important because she'll only lay her eggs, right?
Right.
On that plant, because that's what the babies will eat. And what about this business? I heard that some butterflies are toxic. Are the monarch butterflies toxic also? I think they are.
Right. They get arsenic from the milkweed, so they are toxic. But they're not. I think if at one point somebody said he took a bite of a toxic butterfly in some Amazon rainforest to see how he felt,
yeah.
And I actually called him up when I was writing the book. Because I said, I really want to put this in the book. I want to know exactly how you felt when you bit the toxic butterfly. And he said, actually, I didn't bite it. I told somebody a story, but I didn't bite it. So we really don't know. It's toxic to a predator. And the interesting thing about toxicity in this way is that it won't kill the predator. The purpose of it is to teach the bird or other animal that you better stay away from this kind of butterfly or it'll make you sick to your stomach. It makes them ill, and then they stay away from any butterfly that looks like the monarch. So there are various mimics that resemble the monarch. They stay away from, a smart bird will stay away from any butterfly that looks that way.
Yeah, when we were in Mexico at the wintering place of the monarchs, we saw birds trying to eat monarchs. And they're toxic to a lot of birds, but some birds
are
not.
That's right.
And I notice also that the birds won't eat the whole butterfly.
That's right.
They'll only pick certain parts to eat it because they have learned not to eat the whole butterfly because it will make them sick.
Right.
And they get their toxicity, as I learned, from the milkweed.
Right.
Okay, so when the caterpillar starts eating the milkweed plant, okay, they take into their system this chemical. What is it? I don't remember what it is. Is it an acid or something?
It's arsenic. It's an arsenic derivative.
It's a pretty nasty stuff. So don't ever eat milkweed. It's not good in your salad. And so the caterpillar takes it into its body. And when the caterpillar does its amazing metamorphosis and changes into a butterfly, the toxin carries through into the adult butterfly.
Right.
So... that's part of the amazing story of the monarch also. So tell us something about the book, Carol, that you wrote on butterflies. Is it a family kind of book? Is it aimed, some of the chapters? I know I read it years ago. It was terrific. And it's sort of a question and answer format.
Question and answer format. We did that based on all the questions that people ask us in the conservatory. We have hundreds of visitors coming through every week, and lots of them have all kinds of questions. And just when we think we knew all the answers, somebody else would come with another question that nobody knew the answer to. And so I would go home and look it up so that the next week I'd be prepared. And so that seemed like a natural format for the book. And so, and all of the books are in that question and answer format. And there, we try to start off with the simple answer and then develop it and talk about more detail and more complex aspects of it. And we incorporate research that's related to the topic that we're answering the question about, so that if you're reading it with a child and they say, how many legs does a butterfly have? You can look up that question and get the simple answer. Mm-hmm. If you want to know more about the legs, and if you're reading it yourself or you want to have more detail, you just keep reading and there's a lot more information. Yeah. So it sort of works on all levels.
I know the title of the book is Do Butterflies Bite?
Right.
So you want to answer that quickly for us?
Right. Well, they can't.
They have some
caterpillars bite. But in the butterfly stage, they don't have any apparatus with which to bite. They just have a proboscis, which is like an elephant's trunk. It's a long tube-like.
It's not quite as big as an elephant's
not
trunk.
Not quite. Right. Right. But they just stick that in the flower and sip the nectar. It's like a straw. And that's the only mouth part that they have. So it's impossible for them to bite.
So then butterflies don't eat at all when they're adults. They just get
drink
nectar from flowers and...
Right. Well, and the moths. We have moths in the conservatory that don't eat at all. That's amazing to me because I love to eat.
Yeah.
They don't eat or drink, certain types of moths. They have no mouth parts at all, and they live off their body fat. They have big fat bodies when they emerge. And the ones we have, Atlas moths, are like that. They only live for about a week, and they spend all their time trying to attract a mate, giving off pheromones, sexual attractants, and then they die.
Hmm. So you cover the moths in the book also?
Yes, there's a lot about moths as well.
So they're all in the same family. They're all Lepidopteras, and most Lepidopteras are moths.
By far.
So really, butterflies are moths, but we call them butterflies. And what about the name butterfly? Everybody asks about that.
Well, butterflies and moths are sort of on a continuum, so they're not really exactly the same. There are some differences, but they're certainly very close. Butterfly, we don't really know. It's the old English name was... the name in English comes from the old English, and there were sulfur butterflies. These very pale yellowish-white butterflies were very common in England. And the thought is that because they were butter-colored, before butter was colored yellow, naturally butter is a very light yellow, and that they were called butterflies because of that. But the names in other languages. We have a whole chart in the book with names
in
other languages. Yeah, because it's a lot of fun. And when we have visitors, especially one of our volunteers named Janet, was very busy writing into the book names of in foreign languages that we had missed.
Right.
And so we have a very comprehensive list of how to say butterfly in all sorts of languages.
Right. Yeah. So that's really good. So I've gone through the book, and it's really terrifically done. And it would make a great family gift for a whole family. And it's small enough, you could put it in your pocket if you wanted to take it out in the field. It's not quite a field guide, because a field guide for butterflies and moths would be a ton. I mean, there are some, but they're very heavy because there are so many critters.
Right.
But there are enough pictures in there that it would be useful. So what I'm going to just say a few words about how you folks listening in can help the monarch butterflies. Because they're in trouble. And the reason they're in trouble is they're losing their habitat.
They've been a lot of forestation in that area, a lot of cutting down the trees. They try to have a moratorium on it in certain areas, but the habitat is really being transformed so that there aren't trees for them to hide in a lot of places where they normally would migrate.
Yeah. And also, the farmers now are using the genetically modified crops, which they think affect the butterflies because it's a bacteria, and it may be affecting the butterflies. I don't know. I read a little bit about it, but, you know, there's so much information now, so I don't really know. But I know that they're losing their habitat because along roadways, they used to see milkweed, and now they just plant grass. They mow it all down.
Mm-hmm.
So you can help the monarch butterfly on their journey north. And what you can do is you can make a way station. Even if you have a tiny little garden, you can plant milkweed. And to find out about that, there's a great site called Monarch Watch, which you mentioned before. Mm-hmm. It's the University of Kansas. Right. And if you go online and type in Monarch Watch, you'll get all this information, some of it that Carol has covered today. But they'll send you milkweed seeds for your zone. You know, we have gardening zones all through the country, depending on temperature and all that stuff. And they'll send you other information on the monarch. And you can actually have a way station. And if the monarchs that are returning north find you a little spot and you have milkweed planted, they may stay there their whole life cycle. Because, as Carol said, the milkweed is crucial because the female will only lay her eggs on the milkweed. So that's something you can do. Now, if you want to see real live monarchs in New York City right now, you come to our butterfly vivarium at the Museum of Natural History. And the butterfly vivarium will be here the whole winter. It's called the Butterfly Conservancy, and we call it Tropical Butterflies Alive in Winter. And it opened at the beginning of October, and it will be there until the end of May. And we have about 500 live butterflies from all over the earth. So we have many tropical butterflies, and we have many North American butterflies. And it's a beautiful place to come. It's very warm. So if you come in the winter, you'll feel terrific. Like you've taken a trip to the Caribbean, just be able to take off your sweater. So I think that ends the program for today. Next time, Carol and I will probably talk about other critters, maybe bats. So this is the Heritage Radio Network, Carol Butler and Bernie Wise signing off.